Not just a presentation, but a full pitch package, complete with detailed financial analysis and strategy. He knew I could deliver a real face melter of a pitch, a compelling and dramatic story that explained everything. Why now? Why us? The critical path, upside, downside, and competitive advantage. All the stuff that I'd done hundreds of times. After Barnes proved unsuitable for the situation, Greenberg realized he needed me. And here's where Greenberg goes to Borrego Springs. Greenberg's Embraer Legacy 600 jet landed at the alarmingly tiny runway in Borrego Springs just before 10 a.m., and within 15 minutes, he was in a car headed to the Borrego Valley Inn. I'd agreed to meet him at noon in the hotel lobby. It was nearly 10 years earlier that Greenberg had listened to one of my pitches and tried to hire me on the spot. I turned him down, saying I wasn't for hire, but he went on to partner up with me eventually, and together we made a lot of deals that propelled his company into a premier position in the financial markets. Now, that team had disbanded and no deals were happening. At 11:54 a.m., he approached the lobby. This was classic Sam Greenberg, who, like the legendary Carthaginian commander Hannibal, would either find a way or make one. This guy would not fly back without pushing our relationship to the brink. This was just the way he worked. Shortly after 11:30 a.m., I thought about possible scenarios. Was there anything Sam could say to sway me? No, not likely. Was the deal economy coming back anytime soon? No, also not likely. There was a certain peace I had now away from the rat race. Not tied down to any phones and emails. I didn't miss the grind. Not at all. It was getting close to noon and I headed to the lobby. Sam was there, dressed casually, sitting on a blue vinyl couch. Both of us were uncomfortable at first, as if meeting for the first time. We both had our game faces on.
"You know, I can't let the plane idle on the runway for too long, so pack it up and let's just head back to L.A., Greenberg said with a straight face.
Aha, the time frame. It would need to be dealt with soon. Hey, look, at this altitude, after your 25-minute short hop, that jet can idle for 3.5 hours in 98-degree heat with a half tank of fuel, I said, cracking Greenberg's power frame in half with the stronger expert frame. I know about these planes. And I'm hungry. It's your turn to buy me lunch. Greenberg countered the expert frame with a prize frame.
You've never made as much money as you have working with me, he calmly replied. Look at you. You're leaning forward, hanging on every word that I say. You're practically drooling about my deal. That's how much you want it. It's almost sad.
You're throwing the prize frame at me. I taught you way too much, I said, easily handing Greenberg's reframe. Look, we could do this all afternoon. Forget it. Let's just go eat. You're still buying. Follow me. On the way to the sandwich shop, we continued to frame and reframe and deframe about who would buy a $20 lunch, even though Greenberg's fueled, piloted, and fully staffed jet was on the runway burning $8,400 an hour.
Let's get back to doing what we always do, Greenberg said, continuing the conversation at the restaurant.
Market says it's a bad idea, I replied. This was probably an anticipated objection, and he decided to challenge me, chide me a bit.
Oren, why exactly did you come here? He asked. You just ran away. You left because you lost your edge, Greenberg continued. There was a point when I thought you might be one of the best, he said. Now the only thing next to your name will be quitter.
Well, that made my teeth clench. I stood up and gave him a long stare. I was ready to walk right away, right there.
You're mad because I'm right, he said. Maybe you'll come back with me and prove me wrong. You can't hang out and be a hippie or whatever you call this for the rest of your life.
I could feel his neediness, and it was clear that I had the upper hand for the moment. But you never have that upper hand long with Sam Greenberg. Give me a minute to think about it, I told him. The $1 billion figure for this deal was off the charts. I'd been accustomed to pitching deals in the $30 million range. This would be the biggest deal I'd ever put together. And it was only falling into my wheelhouse because the bad economy had sent everyone else scrambling. The fact that Greenberg had flown out to the middle of the desert also gave me a sense of importance and a notion that loyalty still existed in the cutthroat world of investment banking. Let's talk about this, I said finally, looking at Greenberg. What exactly are you offering if I do get back into the game? Well, Greenberg's eyes lit up. The bullying he had done had worked. He now had a hook point. It was time for him to take advantage. For the next 15 minutes, he explained the deal, pitched it actually, and laid out my role in the big picture. Then he closed the deal and sealed it, giving me some reasonable terms and a rare handshake. Little did I know that Greenberg had withheld a key piece of information. There was a competitor in this pitch, and a big competitor. Preparing the big pitch. The next day back in Los Angeles, Greenberg and I got together at his office, a high-rise office in the middle of downtown, to discuss an action plan. It was Wednesday. Greenberg came to the meeting knowing that he'd have to mention the competitor, but he waited until the end of the meeting and then sprung it on me. "Did I mention that Goldhammer is pitching the deal too?" Greenberg asked. I almost spit up my coffee. "What?" "Yeah, they have a team on it," Greenberg said. "Relax, it's nobody that we can't take down." "You knew that when you flew out and you didn't tell me?" "What does it matter?" Greenberg said, trying to play it down. "It matters because they beat us most of the time," I said. "Goldhammer is Goldhammer. They have 10 times the resources. They have the Goldhammer pedigree."
"That's why I got you, so we could beat them," Greenberg said.
"No," I said, "you didn't disclose this, and if you had, I would not have come. I'll go toe-to-toe with anyone, but this is not a fair fight." I was really mad. Greenberg had purposely withheld this information, and now I felt betrayed. We were up against Goldhammer, who would throw 12 to 15 people at the effort against our 6. But the potential reward certainly made the effort worth it. If we won the pitch and actually raised the $1 billion for the airport over a period of 5 years, Greenberg Capital would reap more than $25 million in fees. Of that, I would take 30%. So I had a lot to prove, a lot at stake, and a lot to gain. All I had to do was take down Goldhammer and my old arch rival, Timothy Chance. Meanwhile, at Goldhammer, the Goldhammer office in Los Angeles occupies the entire 12th floor of a gorgeous downtown skyscraper with a view all the way across Hollywood to the Pacific Ocean. The floor is decorated throughout with touches from the Orient, a jade dragon, ornate vases, and Japanese flower arrangements. I'd tangled with Goldhammer before, so I've been in that office. I could picture in my head exactly how the company's planning session against my team was going. This is how I envisioned it. Inside the main conference room, 7 people would be gathered to discuss a big deal, a monster deal, the airport deal. The discussion would be led by Bill Miner, a second-generation investment banker who had been handpicked by Goldhammer Corporate to lead the Los Angeles office. It was Miner who had chosen the Far East motif of that office, and Miner often quoted his favorite book, Sun Tzu's Art of War. After briefing everyone on the background of the airport, he would turn his attention to the competitors. That's us. "There are 3 or 4 of the usual suspects involved," he would say, "but the wild card is Greenberg Capital." The name would be familiar to all of them. We were local, and occasionally, Goldhammer and Greenberg would cross paths. Goldhammer's top pitch guy, Timothy Chance, would be quietly listening. He knew us, and he had worked with me a few months in the 90s, and since then, we had clashed several times. 3 years ago at a funding conference, Chance and I had exchanged words and had to be separated physically. In the end, I imagined Chance and Miner would look at each other, both knowing that this was the biggest pitch of the year, the one that bonuses would rest on, and it would be the one deal that would let the industry know who was the best. Strategy sessions and research. The first meeting at Greenberg Capital was a strategy session. Sam Greenberg, Rob McFarlane, and I sat in a conference room, and Greenberg delegated the various responsibilities. The pitch was a risk for all parties. The legal fees alone would be nearly $40,000, and the final bill for all the soft costs would be close to $100,000. McFarlane and I began the long and arduous task of running numbers on the deal. McFarlane was a quantitative analyst, and he knew the types of financial models that were needed. I had the role of putting together the big picture and the storyline, and I would be the one to actually make the presentation. Greenberg would pay the bills and make sure that everything was tracking to his liking. A few hours later, we took a break for lunch and started talking about Goldhammer.
"I'm wondering if they're going to bring in Timothy Chance," Greenberg said.
"I hope so," I said. "He's the best they have, and the good news is that I know how his mind works."
"What do you think, Rob?" Greenberg asks.
McFarlane had a conflict of interest because he freelanced for Goldhammer as well. He shrugged. "My job is to run the numbers, not to pick sides." "Go ahead, you can say it," I told him. "Well, Timothy's as good as they get," McFarlane said. "He's super polished, but I'm sure you are too." Greenberg watched me wince and smiled to himself. I taught him frame control, and now he was using it on me. Nice. This was typical Greenberg, always playing the game, trying to get people to work beyond their limits. "You know what I think," I said. "If they do bring in Timothy, it will make things difficult. He's good." We were making progress on the financing structure of the deal. We'd done research on comparable deals worldwide and felt that we had a good finance strategy in place with a track record to back it up. We also confirmed that, indeed, Timothy Chance would be making the pitch on behalf of Goldhammer. This provided a jolt of adrenaline to help me through the late nights of preparation. Over the years, I'd been obsessed with putting together a method to the madness of presenting and closing deals. I developed the concept of neurofinance, perused scholarly journals, interviewed professors and researchers, and even set up experiments with executives to gauge their reactions to various pitching styles. However, all this research, as well as the 10,000 hours I'd spent on the subject, would do nobody any good unless it really worked. And it was clear that this $1 billion airport pitch would be the ultimate test of what I'd learned, and if Greenberg Capital won, the ultimate confirmation of my methods. Let me take you to the middle of January. The daily rhythm of work, the rhapsody of ticking things off the to-do list, the grind of crunchy numbers, these things were giving me a sense of purpose and a daily jolt of exhilaration. I didn't tell Greenberg, but I'd been bored out there in the desert. Yeah, hot sand feels good on your toes, but if you're used to being a gunslinger, there's nothing like being in a live deal. McFarlane had come over to my home to discuss the latest numbers, and I was explaining this very thing, the thrill of the deal. In a sense, it's very gladiator-oriented. I said, you have to kill or be killed. And if you go down, if you fail, the spectators, the people you're pitching, they often experience a perverse joy. McFarlane nodded. I was always giving him vivid and clarifying metaphors, but McFarlane wasn't wired to really pay attention to all that. He was an introvert who only broke out of quiet mode to defend his financial analysis. He was a numbers guy with a low-key personality. Who is Goldhammer using to run these numbers, I asked. Do you know? Well, they're doing it in-house, so it'll be Brandon Caldwell, McFarlane replied. Can he do what you do, I asked. Well, what do I do, McFarlane wondered. You make magic out of the mundane, I complimented him. No, McFarlane said, Caldwell can't do what I do, not with this short timeline. And this was the most bravado that I could pull out of McFarlane at the time. In McFarlane and me, Greenberg had indeed lined up two very skilled professionals. But Greenberg was no slouch either. He was a math whiz, and when I was just starting in the business, I looked up to him, and he was my pitching mentor. This little team certainly had the talent and the experience. We just had a lot to overcome to bring the airport deal home. Let's talk about the client. Simon Jeffries owned the airport deal. He had worked for years to get all the pieces in place. Jeffries and Greenberg knew each other for more than a decade, and from time to time, they'd see each other in these development circles. Now, Jeffrey was in an alpha status position. He was the guy who would hear the Goldhammer and the Greenberg pitches and ultimately decide who would get the contract to raise $1 billion for the new airport. Interestingly, when Chance was probably doing tons of research on Jeffries, I did none. I was not interested in building a so-called deep rapport, a personal connection with my audience. My research had shown that small talk at the beginning of a pitch typically was fruitless. People who make million and billion dollar decisions don't care whether you play golf or whether you had trouble finding a parking spot. I'd learned this early on and avoided the deep rapport trap that many pitchmen step into. I would be focused instead on a unique theme and a great storyline, a compelling human drama. On paper, the proposed Jet Park Airport is beautiful. A renowned architect had designed a 1,000-acre metropolis built around the famous Davis Field runway, which extends nearly 7,000 feet. The plans include restaurants, shopping, and amenities. Most of the buildings, now just renderings, would be multi-story glass and steel monoliths. No detail had been spared. The revamped airport was expected to help Southern California deal with a staggering rise in air traffic. An estimated 30 million passengers will fly out of LAX in 2010 alone. The airport would service smaller aircraft and provide quality office space for businesses that support the aviation industry. All told, the airport was expected to bring 10,000 jobs and have an economic impact of $2.2 billion. Getting funding, therefore, was serious business. Southern California needed the new airport. The new airport needed money, and both Greenberg and Goldhammer needed to win this pitch. 9 days before the big pitch, McFarlane was working 16-hour days reconfiguring the deal structure and the numbers. Today, I was working with a graphic designer on creating the visual face melters to accompany the pitch, the visuals. I wanted the visuals for the presentation to pop and shock. I was also working on the elements of the story. Some of my friends were Hollywood screenwriters, and they had beat it into me. Every pitch needs to tell a story. There's got to be an intrigue hook, I told McFarlane. If the shark in Jaws has a GPS beacon on it, and you know where it is all the time, there's no drama, and the story is not interesting. I was now reframing the entire campaign to include a human element. Sometimes deals are done strictly on numbers, but not this time. This time it was about people. McFarlane nodded and got back to his numbers. The day of the pitch arrives. At 2:52 p.m. on pitch day, I saw Tim Chance entering the building a few steps ahead of me. In the main building lobby, I went over the pitch again and again in my head. The plan was to focus on the Hollywood story aspect, to talk about the people I'd met in Spring Hill, the community where the airport would be located. I felt certain that neither Tim Chance nor anyone else at his firm had ever set foot in Spring Hill before. As I made my way up the elevator to the 9th floor, I had a quiet confidence in my pitch strategy. The financial structure was solid. Greenberg Capital, my firm, had a strong track record to stand on. But the story I'd prepared had something stronger, a human angle that was compelling. Simon Jeffries' office covers 3,000 square feet of prime Los Angeles office space. I walked in the reception area and saw Chance tapping out a text. We made eye contact, and I arched my eyebrows, my way of saying hello, and turned to the receptionist. The Greenberg team is here, I said, grinning. Go ahead and have a seat, she said. There were 6 chairs in this beta-trapped lobby. Rather than sit, I tried to provoke Chance a little. Hey, are you texting headquarters for a little last-minute advice? But he was not in a mood to talk. He knew this was frame control in action. Anything he said would be frame, deframe, reframe, and flipped. Good luck, Chance said, and he looked back down at his iPhone. Jeffries eventually entered the reception area and shook hands with me and then Chance. Okay, gentlemen, come this way, he said. He led us down a long hallway into a conference room. Have a seat, he said. Chance and I exchanged an uneasy look. Jeffries excused himself, and as soon as he was out of earshot, Chance said to me, we're pitching in front of each other? You gotta be kidding me. Perfect. This happens all the time, I said. You should get out and pitch more. When Jeffries probably knew that if he listened to both of us pitch on our own terms, he'd get our rehearsed efforts. If he was going to trust either of us to raise $1 billion, he wanted to see how we reacted when things didn't go as planned. Just then, a third pitchman entered. He was from a firm in London. This thing was going to be even more competitive than I had anticipated. Anatomy of a pitch. 2 months ago, I'd begun sizing up Goldhammer and wondering how I could get an advantage. Both of our teams would be working from the same information. So what would make the difference? It was a puzzle to solve, with the winner earning the opportunity to raise $1 billion and getting a $25 million payday. Despite the stakes, I'd rewired my mind to think about it as just another pitch, so I wouldn't feel all the pressure or do anything desperate when the moment came. Easy to say, but difficult to do. How do you spend weeks or months working on a big presentation and not be anxious about it? I had to invert my own psychology because, as human beings, we are all hardwired to be emotional about important social encounters. What worked for me were the 3 rules of eradicating neediness. 1, eliminate your desires. It's not necessary to want things. Sometimes you have to let them come to you. 2, be excellent in the presence of others. Show people one thing that you're very good at. And 3, withdraw. At the crucial moment, when people are expecting you to come after them, pull away. If I could not eliminate my desire to win while preparing, the team would likely seem needy and desperate on the day of the pitch. If I could not be excellent at pitching just one simple idea, then the competition would win because they were, on average, stronger. If I didn't have the nerve to withdraw at the right time, then I would just end up chasing the deal and therefore losing it. I knew that this had become a simple game involving the 4 pitch phases and that I should just have fun playing it. Towards that end, the first task for the team was to understand the mindset of Simon Jeffries. I had to tune my pitch message to Jeffries' crocodile brain. First, I had to hit the right tone. In fact, this would be a formal affair. Jeffries had been dealing with the Federal Aviation Administration, the FAA, for several years. That experience surely would have set the fun dial too low. These guys wouldn't be used to freewheeling humor and high energy. Jeffries was also working with the city, the state, and federal agencies, so I would have to show a certain serious, respectful tone. But a serious tone doesn't mean somber. Having fun with the pitch was absolutely critical. If the presentation isn't fun for the person giving it, then everyone else becomes anxious. And because there's no way to fake having fun, I would really have to be enjoying myself. That in itself would eliminate desire. Second, I had to get the frame right. This can be explained quite simply. The competition would make this about money and profits. They were sure to frame this deal as a money-making opportunity. That's what they always did. What was being overlooked by these Wall Street types is that Simon Jeffries is not the head of just any old development company. He was the head of a company that was about to redevelop one of the most historically significant airport runways in Southern California. Jeffries would want to be known as the man who saved Davis Field when others couldn't. This redevelopment plan had been tried many times before and failed. Jeffries would be building an airport on 1,000 acres of Southern California land, land with a history dating back to the 1920s. This didn't have to be a deal about money. Instead, it could be about something bigger, something that tapped into the human desire to be the alpha in every social situation. The brain is wired to do things to achieve status, not money. And within that notion, the big idea was born. This deal was about legacy. This deal was about building a legacy from a piece of American history. Simon Jeffries wanted to be remembered for doing something important. That is desire working, not greed. In this realization, the hard work was done. All I had to do was tune my pitch to the desire and be part of the plan by which Jeffries could secure his legacy. Third, I had to hit the buttons that produce hot cognitions with a sledgehammer. All the hours logged on Sam Greenberg's plane had made an impression on me. Jets are intoxicating. Plain and simple, there's no way around it. They are pure hot cognition. Jeffries and the committee were deeply involved in the aviation business. They either owned planes or they worked with them. Two were pilots themselves. When presenting to someone who loves jet aircraft, hitting hot buttons is almost too easy. You just show lots of visuals of what? Jets. Any product that your target consciously or subconsciously believes will enhance his social image will get his brain hot with desire. Show the brain something that society values, and you won't just be hitting hot buttons, you'll be stomping on them. Dopamine will pour into the reward structure of the brain, and the emotion of pleasure will rise fast. It's the same reward structure that's involved in the response to recreational drugs. When most people enter a social interaction that involves something like a Ferrari, a Rolex, beautiful ornaments, a Renoir, Cezanne, a Titian, or a De Kooning, a pedigreed Rottweiler, a beachfront mansion, or in this case, a private jet, their hot cognitions fire like crazy. They anticipate desire and rewards, and it feels good to them. This is why I plan to show Jeffries and the committee large poster boards covered with what I call aviation porn. Every few minutes, I'd flip around a new poster board, each with an increasingly provocative photo of a beautiful jet taking off, landing, or doing a high bank turn. In other presentations, when pitching derivatives or abstract financial instruments, it was much harder to hit the target's hot buttons visually. But with this deal, the jet narrative would make it really easy. I knew if I could just make it to the final selection, it would come down to Goldhammer and to us. They had the deepest bench, the best track record, and the most influence. The inventory of their strengths was awesome. In the preceding 10 years, they had trounced us whenever we went after the same target. There is no doubt that they would be discounting us because of our small size. I personally raised a couple $100 million, but those guys, Goldhammer was doing billions. As the presentation began to take shape, I built it around four phases. Phase one, frame control, grab status, introduce the big idea. Phase two, explain the problem, solution, and our special advantage. Phase three, offer the deal. And phase four, stack frames for hot cognition. There was a deeper problem than just the competition. Simon Jeffries and the committee were natural alphas. During the pitch, they would be vocal, disruptive, and distracting. If I didn't see status and control the frame, these guys certainly would. At any point, if my pitch slowed to a crawl, they would jump in and try to assert their alpha status. They'd demand to know, how do you plan to do it specifically? Or where did you get those figures? Or how much will such and such cost? To keep them out of this detective mode, I would need to constantly deploy push-pulls. This would keep them either rocked back on their heels or leaning forward and intrigued to know more. They wouldn't have time to become cold and analytical. They wouldn't be able to disrupt the frame. They would always be in my frame reacting to me. I would have to seize star power, and I'd have to seize it early. My pre-pitch thoughts. Here's what was running through my head at the last minute. Number one, get the tone right. Frame myself as the alpha, seize status, and hit their hot buttons. Number two, deploy a big idea that is human and captures the theme of building a legacy. Number three, keep it captivating with visuals that resonate. And number four, create hot cognitions. Make Jeffries and the committee want the idea before they even knew the details. The plan was to have a 20-minute high-temperature conversation with the target's croc brains. The goal was to achieve a pitch full of hot cognitions. I believe that if two equally skilled people pitch the same idea, and one tunes it to the neocortex, and the other tunes it to the crocodile brain, you have two very different results. I had tuned my pitch for the target's croc brains, and I was ready to start. The presentation. I'd been preparing for over 2 months, and now, with Chance watching me, I stood up to address Jeffries and the committee. Speaking slowly, I began. There is a tremendous responsibility for all of us today. This is a decision not about who is the most charming or who's the most skilled in finance, but instead about who has the right ideas that can raise $1 billion for Davis Field. Others have tried this kind of thing before and failed. So it's not that the best man should win or that the best team should win, but instead the best ideas should triumph today. This runway has served the United States of America in World War II and hosted squadrons of B-17 bombers and other fighter planes, and they all took part in the Pacific campaigns. Today, we are not talking about building a shopping center or a strip mall or a motel. We are building an airport, and we are doing it on hallowed ground. This has to be done right. It was critical to get the frame right at the beginning. And because Goldhammer definitely would open by highlighting their size, their experience, and their track record, I had to pick a frame that minimized their strengths and focused the lens of attention on our strengths. This is why I chose the best idea frame. In other words, I was telling the targets they should forget about picking a bidder with size and power. Instead, they should focus on the quality of ideas. We could not compete on size and power against the others, but if I changed the frame, if my big idea frame was stronger than Goldhammer's, then we could still win. I'd also cranked up the tension, injecting norepinephrine into their brains by saying, "This is hallowed ground." In other words, a screw-up would have serious consequences. If I'd hit the tone just right, then a strong frame would be in place, and the next task was to reframe the competition. I continued, "We are honored to be competing against two other great firms today. I know each of them could serve you well because they have large teams, multiple offices, legions of young, energetic researchers, and the best paid analysts in the world. And when working a deal, these firms spare no expense to tackle the job." This was my way of saying that Goldhammer and the group from London were big, bloated corporations with too many people and many of them young and inexperienced. With this statement, I had reframed the competition as young, overstaffed, worried about their fees, and generally overweight. This fit the general image that dogged Wall Street banks in the media and would be an easy idea to convey. I knew that Goldhammer's Tim Chance would have to invest much of his precious time digging his company out of that frame. Chance recognized what I'd done, and it's no wonder he was scowling. Things had started well for us. "Simon," I continued, "the vast majority of people you have met in the last 3 months have told you that the market is flat and that nothing has changed for some time. But if you start challenging the way those folks are thinking, you can start to see this market through a different lens, the lens we use. Let me explain. Three market forces that we follow very carefully have formed an important market window that we can step through if we time it right together. We don't think the window stays open for long, but if we do this now, we can go get $1 billion from investors faster than any other deal out there. Here's our analysis on the way the markets are moving. Here are the social factors. Everyone is tired of investment bankers getting fat off these deals with no risk. So we have to be more transparent on our fees and the economic factors. For deals that are transparent, where the bankers and the consultants are willing to risk alongside investors, there's a ton of investor money in the market, $5 billion more than even last quarter. And the technology factors. If we go green and make the buildings in this airport rebuild LEED certified, I know a government agency that will get us 10% reduction in taxes. That's a lot. I know this is news to you, but this is how the market is moving, and these three forces are important to our strategy. Again, we have a short market window to step through. If we fight against these forces, we will struggle. But if we hit it right, we'll be one of the few deals that gets through this small market window and succeeds. This was a three market forces pattern that I had long endorsed. Simple and straightforward. I wasn't going to start selling and promoting before I was done framing. That would be a mistake. By doing it this way, I would show the targets how the market was moving. This would work because the mind is not a camera. It's a machine dedicated to observing motion and predicting what will happen next. I continued, before going into my plan in detail, let me tell you what we recognized some time ago. This project is more than an airport upgrade or an airport relaunch. It is a legacy that you will leave behind. You will have your names written in history, and you will be judged by generations to come by what you build right here. I had issued a challenge to the committee. Done this way, it creates a dopamine and norepinephrine kick at the same time. In other words, they would feel the twin pull of desire and tension. Simon, Jeff, Jim, I addressed the committee by their first names. I know you need to find investors for this airport as fast as possible, and I appreciate how questioning conventional wisdom is hard to do when the time is tight. But today, we're going to ask you to question how things have always been done, because lately, the usual way of doing these deals turns out to be wrong or wide off the mark or both. There are too many similar Me Too deals in this market. Right now, unless you are different in your approach from all the others, you will be wasting time and you will be wasting money. That's why our big idea is different from all the other plans you're going to see. I flipped around a few big poster boards with the theme and the logo type boldly printed on them. As you can see, our theme is invest in an American legacy. Our plan gives plenty of profit to investors, but also gives them a chance to be part of an amazing story. Unlike the other bidders here today, my competitors, who will just be telling the potential investors a profit and loss story, we plan to tell the investors a wonderful story about an airport that has a rich aviation history. The combination of the American legacy theme with our financial plan will work best in this market. Our approach will raise $1 billion faster and more easily. Our big idea delivers a better velocity of capital and more certainty that you will get the money you need. We're going to set our sights high to literally become heroes by protecting and not destroying a piece of aviation history and get $1 billion at the same time. This was my classic big idea introduction pattern. Why would this kind of introduction for the big idea work here? There are three basic truths about the brain and decision-making that went into it. First, the most basic working principle of the brain is decisions of wanting something are not conscious. Second, the opportunity to gain a social reward, such as becoming a hero, is even more enticing than making money. And third, you can flood the target's brain with dopamine by focusing on three ideas. One, the idea of social rewards. Two, the idea of becoming a hero. And three, the idea of making a lot of money. The purpose, ignite desire. Now, at this point of the pitch, I'd serve the committee's crocodile brains the right cocktail of dopamine, which is desire, and norepinephrine, which is tension, and I was free to proceed with the boring stuff, the numbers. By creating a frame that focused the attention of the targets on what we were good at, I put some distance between ourselves and Goldhammer. Being different also creates novelty, and that gets the dopamine injectors of the brain flowing. Traditional pitches often start out, hey, we worked really hard to come out with a great plan, but my approach takes two steps back and then goes three steps forward. It begins by saying, things have changed out there in the market, and the normal approach is not going to work. And it ends up by saying, there is a better way that is different from the others. And it's different because it just isn't cold, hard numbers. It has a human story to it. The other groups probably would do precisely the wrong things. They would focus a huge amount of time on their wonderful resumes. They would all be using the same theme, only the details would be different, relying on cliches, framing themselves as a full-service firm that caters to clients and provides the highest levels of integrity, service, and quality. There is nothing gained with that old, ineffective way. So why waste time pitching in that manner? Doesn't everyone just assume that you're going to provide service, quality, and integrity? Over the next 5 minutes, I gave highlights of the budget, what timeline I could deliver on. If I could not pitch the full plan in 5 minutes, then the last 2 months would become a very expensive waste of time and money. In preparing for this day, the difficulty was knowing what to take out of the pitch without stripping away the richness and the complexity of the idea. But I felt I would have a better chance of success with fewer cold, hard details, the kind that switched the brains of the targets into analytical mode. The length of the pitch also was of paramount importance. During a rehearsal a month earlier, the pitch came in at more than 55 minutes, way too long. So I started hacking. I added 3 minutes from the total, then another 2 minutes, and so on. With each new rehearsal, I removed details that lacked intrigue or hot cognition. As recently as 1 week before the presentation, I was still working on making the pitch hotter, shaving away distracting details while keeping the core message. So now here I was, pushing through the budget and the financing details in about 5 minutes. It was the coldest part of the pitch. Soon, I would deliver the four-frame hot cognition stack, which would definitely heat things up. But first, a quick push-pull. Gentlemen, is this plan bold? Well, we can certainly debate if my numbers are 5% too high or 3% too low, but there's no doubt the big idea is bold. We think that boldness is important. And if you don't like bold plans, then there's a real possibility we are not right for each other, because my team would always be working quickly in an entrepreneurial and bold way, and you would always be responding like a big corporation, slow and methodical. And how could that ever work? So I'm okay with the notion that our plan is too bold and that we aren't right for each other. Here, I was employing the classic push part of the push-pull pattern, which challenged the targets and amplified tension. Now it was time to back off. I had a lot going on here, drawn on the techniques and research that had consumed me for more than a decade. No matter what kind of soft touch I had, there was still a form of selling involved. I was trying to get the targets to decide in my favor, trying to take control. And to my targets, this was a form of stress and pressure. Humans behave a certain way when they're put under this kind of pressure. At a basic level, in the target's croc brain, there's a feeling that you're taking away his or her autonomy. A threat response could be triggered. The push would counter this problem, giving the targets the opportunity to make a pressure-free decision. Because the human brain evolved in response to stressors over thousands of years, humans are constantly attuned at the level of the croc brain to the ways social encounters threaten their capacity for choice. This is one of my guiding theories. The slightest perception that you are taking away free will, scientists call this reducing the autonomy of choice, will trigger a threat response. After letting the croc brain know that it didn't have its back against the wall, it was time to complete the other half of the push-pull pattern. But then again, gentlemen, if this did work out, our forces could combine to become something great. Imagine your aviation experience and passion combined with our strategy and financial know-how, almost like some kind of superpower. When we focus our gaze on any individual investor, he would just explode with desire. I then returned to the idea of status. The brain is always assessing how social encounters either enhance or diminish its status. Yet at this point, all the competitors had higher global status than we did. There was no way around that. They had more wealth, more popularity, and more power. That's the three measures of status. So I needed some local star power, and I needed it fast. Look, in all seriousness, we love this project. I started flipping over heavy poster boards that were set around the room. These were big, physical, real-world boards about a half inch thick each. Unlike a PowerPoint slide, which would just disappear when I was done with it, these would remain, adding a certain concrete feeling of reality to the whole pitch. and I know how difficult it is not to choose Goldhammer or the London team sitting here with us today. How great are those guys? Is there anything they can't do with all that youthful energy and those amazing bespoke suits they're wearing? But one thing I would have to ask them, how much do they know about Spring Hill pickup football? This was a novelty play that would keep attention high, but it was risky because if you're going to go off on a tangent, it had better be good. There's a reason I ask, because the full story of Davis Field and why the previous attempts to build a new airport here have failed cannot be fully told until you meet Joe Ramirez. I had indeed met an auto mechanic named Joe Ramirez while doing my research on the airport deal. He was tall with wavy hair and a prematurely graying goatee. Now, here he was, striding across the room, dressed as if he was going to church. You can imagine how a mechanic would have been received by the committee in the middle of a pitch for a $1 billion contract. Nobody expected this. Clearly, he was not here to explain the financial plans or the flight intervals. I urged him to take his time and speak from the heart. The clock was ticking, but this moment was too rich to be rushed. Joe moved in front of the lectern and pulled from his pocket a folded piece of notebook paper. He read aloud his prepared comments. I grew up in Spring Hill. It has been my home since my father came here from Dallas, Texas. As a kid, there wasn't much to do. We didn't have the mall and the theaters and the skateboard park as it is now. But what we did have is a football field. It was at the airport here, and he pointed to a place on the map just adjacent to the runway. Every Saturday and Sunday, we played football there. Two or three games would be going all at the same time. This place was easy for everyone to get to, and some of my best memories growing up happened right here. But in 1997, and nobody knows why, the city paved the field over. It's been an empty parking lot since that day. If there's anything you can do. You could clearly see the emotion in Joe's face. You'd have to either have been a robot from an alien planet, not to have been moved yourself. When Joe said that the city had paved the football field into an unused parking lot, there was a certain heaviness in the room. Heightened states of emotion create strong memories. Where were you when such and such famous person died? It's easy to remember. The parts of the brain where memories are stored needs to distinguish between significant experiences and those which carry less importance. This was one such moment. While it's hard to define emotion specifically, what is not hard is to show its effect on cognition and decision-making. Emotions are how we encode things of value and how we link events to our memory. If it is true that emotional intensity creates a moment where attention is high and encoding is high and where desire could be created, I would not get a better opportunity to create wanting from this committee. I thanked Joe Ramirez and stepped back in front of the room. Simon, committee, you see, we can look at the numbers behind this deal all day long. 24% of this, 15% of that, $100 million for solar panels, $100 million for construction of just one terminal, $1 billion. It's all just numbers. We've all been thinking of this airport as if it were a purely financial transaction, as if this is a 7,000-foot runway in some kind of cyberspace out there. What I realized just 30 days ago, and what has been forgotten in all our desire to design it and build it and profit from it, is that this airport isn't in cyberspace, and it's no longer 1948 when this runway was in the middle of nowhere. What I'm saying is, 50 years ago, Spring Hill was populated by fewer than 1,000 people, and they were probably outnumbered by jackrabbits. Now, 115,000 people live there. Think about that. We are deciding in this room, 50 miles away from the site, what will be done with 1,000 acres of land in the middle of a community. With this, I put the morality frame into play. It would be hard for the other groups to find a higher set of values to champion than protecting a community of more than 100,000 souls. This frame is so basic, so tied to the workings of the social animal, that it had to be deployed. This was the right moment. Next, the time frame would be used. Gentlemen, I have to finish in 5 minutes, so I don't have the time right now to introduce you to the 37 other friends of mine who live in Spring Hill. You see, I've been living there for the last few weeks in a cool little hotel on Main and 19th Street. I've played pickup football in the dirt field outside of town. That's where I met Joe. So I can tell you, this is an amazing community. They'll support us if we play fair and if we support them as well. Emotion in the room was peaking. Simon Jeffries, he couldn't hold off any longer. He was already leaning forward in the seat of his chair, almost past the edge. "You live there? You know these people?" Jeffries asked. What had been a formal pitch was now becoming a casual conversation. "They're your friends and you know their names?" "I'm good with names," I said, "and those people all had something important to say about this project. This is why our plan includes an athletic part, to return Joe and the community the football field he loved so much growing up. We want a young aviator center to be added to the build. With $1 billion, come on, this is a rich project, and we can afford it. We'll pay for it ourselves, and here are the plans." With that, I flipped around another poster board. Now it was becoming like a game show. "Are you sure you want to commit to these things?" Simon Jeffries asked. "Well, how can we not do it?" I said. "You can't just pull value out of a community. You have to put value back in." Following the principles of seized status, I would now redistribute some of the alpha status that I had and frame control that I was holding to some of the other players. And the park plans with the restoration of the historic football field, listen, they are now complete. They're not just part of my theory. These are real plans. We completed the engineering specifications, and I want them to be part of any plan that goes forward. 5 minutes ago, my team emailed these plans to everyone in this room. No matter what happens with our bid, Simon, whether you choose us or not, we want the football field to be fully restored. I flipped around the final display boards with their beautiful, evocative visuals of aircraft overhead and kids playing football and proud community members holding their arms in open embrace. These were all big picture visuals meant to stoke the fires of hot cognitions. For a closing statement, I would bring it all together. Time frame, prize frame, intrigue, morality frame, push, pull, desire, tension. It was a fireworks finale of frame collisions. Gentlemen, committee, the only thing worse than an idea you hate is an idea that you just like. When you only like an idea, then you're still unsure about it. Imagine being married to someone you only liked. It would seem cold. If I were sitting where you are, what would be important to me? I might think, if we don't love this idea of American legacy, then we have to throw Oren and his team out of here right now. And that would be okay with me because it would be the right thing to do. And by that same measure, if you only like us, then you must also throw us out. And I'm totally okay with that too. Because we could not possibly work with you if you didn't love our big idea. We believe in the big idea that strongly. Right now, as we're sitting here, the terminal paint at Davis Field is peeling. The old observation deck is rotting, and a local park has been paved over with cement. Almost everything about Davis Field Municipal Airport shows age and neglect. It is a place that, by almost every appearance, has been left behind in time. But time should not leave this place behind. The war in the Pacific was fought from this field. Bomber squadrons had thousands of movements here. Men left this field to fight for our country. And for some, it was the last patch of American soil they ever touched. So if you love the idea of American legacy, and you want Joe Ramirez's kids to be able to play on that field, and you want to be known as the capitalist who built a legacy for the ages, then we are the right team to pick today. Because we know how to do this better than anyone else. But we are not going to do this for you. We will have to do it together with you. When you feel that the time is right, I encourage you, come to our office and talk over how we can make this happen. The prize frame had been boiled down to one thing, withdrawal. At a crucial moment, when the committee was expecting me to come after them, I pulled away. I remembered what was once written in the U.S. Air Force training manual. It is generally inadvisable to eject directly over the area you have just bombed. Strictly following this advice, it was time to leave. In the course of my many pitches, I discovered that people won't do what you tell them to do. They must feel as if they have free will to make their own decisions. They won't even know what to do unless you have created primary, basic, and inescapable emotions for them to react to. They can't encode your pitch into their memory without strong rushes of dopamine and norepinephrine, resulting in the twin forces of desire and tension. In that moment, everyone realized that Greenberg's little company of 6 people, plus 7 consultants, had a chance to win against the biggest and best in the financial industry. I had built from scratch a pitch that worked in a market where nothing worked. That's when I realized that this was the most exciting 20 minutes in my career of pitching deals. the competition strikes back. Tim Chance was up next, and as expected, his presentation was polished, practiced, and predictable. He opened with a long explanation of the many large deals his firm, Goldhammer, had done in recent years, the amazing capabilities of his organization and the respected name it held. The logo on his business card was known around the world, and he was using it to his best advantage. There was a moment of unintentional comedy right away. While Tim was making his opening remarks, his team was fumbling with the laptop they had brought, trying to connect it to the conference room projector. Although we've all seen this happen before, it still makes me laugh. With all that at stake, how could they burn 5 minutes trying to set up a projector? We had worked for 2 days to cut just 3 minutes from our presentation. My question was soon answered. As his slide deck came into focus on the screen, I and several others in the room noticed a little number in the lower right-hand corner of the screen. 42. Oh, man. There were 42 slides in his presentation? That was going to take a while. After the review of the Goldhammer Bonafides, information we all knew anyway, Chance launched into a lengthy and detailed opinion of current market conditions. I could feel the temperature of the room falling towards sub-zero, as the cold cognitions he was flashing on the screen were sending our brains into a deep freeze. While he certainly looked good and sounded good from the podium, he was talking about data and not about what really mattered, which should have been why now, how, and the critical path for doing it. Chance was banking on a tried-and-true method that Goliath-sized companies often use. Because they're big and successful, they think it implies that they are also capable, and therefore, they often do not speak directly to how they will accomplish an objective. They believe that their audience assumes it will get done. But will it really? We are left to wonder. In large companies, dealmakers like Chance are rewarded for the business they bring to the firms, not necessarily the results. Each of us had been granted up to 1 hour to present, and unbelievably, Chance had used every minute he was allotted. After 40 minutes of this financial mumbo-jumbo, he was inducing a coma in me. Tim was the only member of his team to speak, and he dragged the audience through every single one of the words and every single one of the densely worded slides. This is doing them no favors, I thought, but it's good for me. Next up was a team from London who mercifully did not speak for an hour. On the contrary, their presentation was the model of European efficiency. Clean, slick, and heavy with emphasis on financial models. This team had the wow factor on their side, too, using an animated three-dimensional digital presentation of their previous aviation projects. I was impressed. They had more experience in aviation than the rest of us combined. Like Goldhammer, they eventually succumbed to the temptation every presenter faces, taking a deep dive into complicated financial figures. And as their team commented on how they would manage the deal, it became clear that this was merely production work to them, no different than any other airport project they've ever worked on. If awarded, they'd stamp this project out like a cookie cutter style. They'd express no interest in the local community, and they seemed to have no concern with the economic impact. They focused only on the project funding, how quickly they could get it, get in, get it done, and get out. I could not help but be impressed by their confidence and felt certain that they could do this deal and do a great job. These guys could win easily. As they finished with their rich European flourish, puffed chest, thick Oxford accents, and broad smiles, the last thing they said was, "So, we would be proud to work on this prestigious project, and we will eagerly wait to hear your decision." Ha! Beta trap! After all that work, showing neediness was the wrong move. Simon Jeffries approached the podium to make some final remarks to all of us. And this guy, Simon, he's a class act. He graciously thanked the teams for their presentations, described the week-long deliberation process he would now preside over, and he quickly brought the meeting to a close. The hour of judgment. After it was all said and done, I sat there looking out the window at Greenberg's Los Angeles office. There were five others with me waiting for a phone call, the phone call. Jeffries, meanwhile, had gathered several members of his selection committee at his office, presumably to discuss last-minute details. As I looked out at Los Angeles, I reflected on the last few months, this pitch and its repercussions. I'd boiled down 2 months of work into a lean and elegant pitch lasting 20 minutes and 52 seconds. Now it would all come down to this call, this moment, the decision. The phone rang. I sat down at the table in the conference room, and Simon Jeffries was put on the speaker. Jeffries began, "If you go down to Davis Field right now, as you pointed out to me, the terminal paint has worn off, and the old observation deck is just rotting away. Almost everything has a hole in it, including important parts of the runway. Who would want to land a jet there, have it serviced there, or take a meeting there? Nobody. Well, this was becoming melodramatic. We just wanted the decision. Jeffries continued. This is why I'm so passionate about the new Davis Field and excited about building a new entrance to the airport and all the new facilities. This can be one of the best private airports in the world, but I have to pick the right team. The Greenberg team, you guys, were fantastic in last week's pitch. There were some things we felt you didn't get right, but we really enjoyed it. This is a hard decision, of course. I'm sorry, we can only pick one winner. Jeffries let the moment linger for a torturous amount of time. And then he cleared his throat and he said one word. Congratulations. Our office erupted into celebration. And for me, the journey back from the desert was complete and my methods were validated. They weren't just a personal collection of pitching notes stuffed in my notebooks. It wasn't just thousands of index cards in my office. It wasn't just a bunch of academic notions or theories. And it wasn't just a checklist of do's and don'ts. Much of the way that calculus is a system for solving math problems, or that civil engineering is a system for building bridges, my strong method was now a system to get deals done, especially when the stakes are high. It works. Chapter 8, Get in the Game. Learning to manage social dynamics is not an intuitive undertaking. 10 years ago, I found myself in many situations where I was the beta. I thought I had to accept this low social status, and I thought that there was almost nothing I could do to control the frame. I didn't even know what a frame was, and I cannot rationally describe to you why in those early days I disliked or even hated traditional sales techniques. I just knew what I wanted, a method that requires no blunt force trauma on my customers, no beggar bash modalities that aggravate people and make them regret doing business with you. I wanted nothing to do with the anxiety and the fear that accompany those beta-trapped, pushy methods. Beta methods do not exist in my approach for the simple reason that you're not pushing. You are interacting with people using basic rules of social dynamics. For years, I've been doing this stuff around the country and the world, and part of what I learned is that the crocodile brain is the same everywhere. There aren't New York croc brains and California editions and special French ones. Every croc brain responds the same. When something is boring, ignore it. When something seems dangerous, fight or run. When something is complicated, radically summarize, causing information loss, and pass it on in a severely truncated form. With my approach, you are respecting the croc brain by introducing a game and you're inviting others to play with you. It will feel new and different to everyone involved because it is. Instead of flogging people with canned responses and pressure tactics, frame-based interactions excite the senses and engage people in a much more social way. In a world of robotic sameness, this approach will distinguish you from all the others. I learned this stuff alone, and it took me more than 10,000 hours of trial and error and many patient and forgiving clients to get it right. In the beginning, I seriously screwed up some important deals, and I should have worked with a partner or a small group, but everyone I talked to about my method was afraid of it. Most thought it was chaotic and unpredictable because I didn't have a model worked out at that point. Today, the method isn't chaotic, and it's not unpredictable at all. Frames are now easy to control, and local star power can be created in every situation. In the most basic sense, what are the frames I've been talking about here? Frames are psychological referencing systems that all people use to gain a perspective and relevance on issues. Frames influence judgment. Frames change the meaning of human behavior. If a friend rapidly closes and opens her eyes, we will respond differently depending on whether we think this is a physical frame, that she blinked, or it is a social frame, that she winked. Consider the words hit, bumped, collided, and smashed. These words tell you the severity of an automobile accident. Frames shape the underlying meaning of every social interaction. It is true, for instance, when we get together for a presentation, meeting, or pitch, that we can't just conduct a wholesale drop and transfer of information. You don't send a cargo transfer container full of information to your customers or potential investors and say, here, look through this stuff, see what you can make of it. They can't absorb it, and if they could, they don't have the time. This is a part of the presenter's problem. Deciding what to pitch and how is not like a math or an engineering problem that can be worked out by having more and more information. It's about figuring out what parts of the information to use, which parts of your deal will trigger cold, analytical processing by the neocortex, and which parts will engage the hot and vibrant processes of the crocodile mind. This is exactly why frame control is so crucial. It serves to filter information and provide meaning, bridging the natural disconnect between you and the target. It is always the case that frames can simplify complex